Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the way forward for a world that cannot rely on fossil fuels indefinitely? While cheap and reliable power from oil and coal helped build the modern economy, the environmental and security costs of that energy provide ample incentive for finding sustainable new sources of power. And my guest today believes it is possible that by the middle of this century, the U.S. economy will be 158% larger than it is today and can get by without oil, coal, or nuclear energy. Michael Potts is president and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute, which has just published the book Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era, written by Amory Lovins and others at the Institute. Michael is in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. That event starts at 6 o'clock. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, we talk about energy fairly often on this show, and I have to tell you, this is a much more optimistic work than we normally find when we're talking about what's going to happen as we transition away from fossil fuels.
Well, thanks for saying that. And I will tell you that we've found that when we work with leaders, they really don't want to be lectured. They don't want to be threatened. They don't want to be scared. But they are open to pathways that make sense. And there is a pathway that makes sense. In fact, there are good economic reasons to make this change to a new energy era. And what we do as an institute is we find the benefits in the long term and the medium term and help decision makers chart a way toward them.
So ultimately, if there is money to be made in this conversion, can it be entirely market-driven, or does public policy need to be part of the formula?
I think public policy needs to be part of the formula. However, with Reinventing Fire, we made the assumption that there were going to be no huge policy changes. Things can be sped by thoughtful policy. But really, if you look at most of the big innovations of the last 30 years, it wasn't from a lawmaker. They come from real market forces and innovators and decision makers making things happen.
So talk about that title, Reinventing Fire. By 2050, essentially, you think that our sources of energy will look very different than they do today.
Well, I can't predict that they will. We think they definitely could. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of the book is to create a roadmap that we can choose to use. And this is different from a lot of other books. There's a lot of great thinking going on. But what we try to do to distinguish this particular work is we actually ran the numbers. We looked at what it takes to get transportation and what it takes to have the right amount of buildings and commerce and industry, but how you could do it with renewable energy. And we found that we could unlock $5 trillion in savings. So the thing about this book is, since we ran the numbers and we collaborated with people in the industry, we were able to set relative importance between different measures. So we could tell you, yeah, we'll do this in buildings, but that thing with vehicles doesn't make as much difference.
Mm-hmm. And you really have to, according to this, you need to look at every aspect of our energy use in order to really affect change.
Exactly. We found that if you were to go at the highest level thematically, there are three things that have to happen. First, we do need to get transportation off of oil. And oil is just a wonderful chemical for powering transportation. But as you mentioned, it's got other implications, including huge economic implications that are becoming more and more intense every year. When we can get transportation off of oil, then we take a look at industry and our buildings. And buildings just consume a huge amount of our fossil fuel energy now. And they're designed wrong because they were designed in an age when nobody cared. What we do is we go through and show how those buildings can be changed and how industry can evolve to use much less energy. And then we have worked with people in the electrical industry, in electricity, to devise a strategy to create electricity in a completely different way that, again, has economic benefit and actually has much less risk to the system, but is based primarily on renewable sources.
So let's unpack some of the things you just talked about. Vehicles, for example, one really important way that we could change them is making them lighter. How do you make them lighter and not less safe?
Good question. We've found that size does relate to safety, but weight does not. So there are a lot of great innovative ways to reduce the weight of vehicles and still keep them safe. But I think most people, the car makers themselves are waking up to it, but most people don't understand that over the last 40 years, our cars have been becoming obese even more quickly than our people have. And it was because, of course, the car companies make what people want to buy, and they like the bigger and bigger cars. And the car companies also don't pay for the fuel in the car. But there are a lot of innovative ways to make cars much lighter. Most people don't realize that that when you drive your car, 5/6 of the fuel you use are just to move the steel around. I mean, you don't say, I'd like to move a bunch of steel to the grocery store. You just want to move yourself. Mm-hmm. So if we can back down, use innovative materials, better design to create a lighter car, then it requires much less fuel. We are finding that the car companies are waking up to that, and they're coming out with these new models. In the next 3 years, you can expect first premium cars, but then standard cars are coming way down in weight, and that's just a win for everybody.
What does that reduced weight cost?
It is more expensive in terms of immediate cost because, first of all, the current production methods assume a lot of steel. Mm-hmm. And most of the weight, there are a lot of forms of weight savings, but most of the weight savings comes from using new composite materials and aluminum and what they call light steel. There are some innovations, and they cost more in the vehicle itself. That's why the lighter, cooler vehicles are premium vehicles to start. But the other element to this is that the cost curves are coming down. The more vehicles that are made this way, the less expensive it is to do it. So we already see, especially in German cars, announcements of light-weighted cars coming in the next 3 to 4 years.
And they still do okay if they were to have, God forbid, a crash with a traditional weight vehicle?
Yes. Well, think of it this way. If you bounce a ping pong ball into a bowling ball, the ping pong ball has its own trajectory, and because it's lighter, there is less damage. But the other neat thing about some of the lightweighted cars is that the engineers are designing crash zones and safety into the design in ways that are innovative. And we'll see, because you don't know until you have 20,000 vehicles on the road. But we think that some of these new safety designs will actually be, or could actually be, safer than big old heavy steel cars.
Let's talk about electric cars as compared with internal combustion engines. Why are they so much more efficient?
Well, the first reason is that you can think of your gasoline car, which, by the way, I drive a hybrid, but, you know, gasoline cars come in handy right now. A gasoline car is like carrying a little power plant around in your car where you just pour in fossil fuels and it, you know, turns it into usable energy. And inherently, that's not going to be as efficient as having energy created in the most effective way and then stored in a battery. So just right there, having this power plant in your car loses about 80% of the energy, the potential energy of the gasoline. But there are a lot of other things. For example, I sat recently with a group of engineers in Detroit, and I asked, okay, I've been hearing that electric cars are easier to maintain. What kind of reduction in maintenance costs would you have with an electric car? And they looked at each other and said 80 to 90%, which is a massive savings for us. By the way, car maintenance has become cheaper every year because of the quality of our cars anyway. But imagine another 4/5 of savings. The good news is it would save us money. The challenge is most car dealerships make money from their service. So that would be hugely disruptive for the industry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say there's another element of cars that is just really exciting right now. And it's tied in with the electric side. One of the challenges we have to electric adoption is that the electric cars aren't far down the cost curve yet. So you can still buy a gasoline-powered car much less expensively. But we expect that to shift. And it will probably not be in the U.S. that the first mass adoption of electric cars happen. We see there's a real possibility that the first mass adoption will happen in lower cost economies, and that'll drive the production curves down. We'll see more in the U.S. There's another interesting and exciting thing about cars, and that is just some of the other technologies that are coming out. A few months ago, I rode in one of the Google driverless cars, and that is just fascinating what they're doing. They've got 180,000 miles that they've driven in cities without drivers, and they expect a world where we can reduce traffic by 20% to 30% because these computers will just be more effective than human drivers. And also where instead of owning a car, in your neighborhood, you just click on your smartphone and a car comes to your house to pick you up or to pick your children up to take them to school. And say you and 100 neighbors share a fleet of one pickup truck, three high passenger cars, two low passenger cars, and you just use them as needed. That's the type of flexibility you'd have if you didn't have to keep your own car in your garage.
How do we get people to drive fewer miles and still be where they need to be?
It is interesting. We're finding that there's very good research out there to say that when people just become a little more conscious of driving, their mileage drops substantially. And some of it is just becoming more aware. Some of it is having more people in the car because 93% of our trips have one person in a car.
Wow.
So if you just think about it a little more, it's easier. But another interesting issue is that as cars start to shift from oil with hybrids and electric cars, etc., it causes a bit of a crisis because most of our roads are maintained through gasoline taxes. And some states, and in fact some insurance companies, are experimenting with charging per mile driven with satellite navigation. As that starts to shift, we're finding another shift where when people pay for the miles they drive fewer miles.
Hmm.
So there are a lot of behavioral choices that people exercise as they become more aware. There's one more generational thing that I find fascinating. I don't know, but did you get your driver's license on your 16th birthday?
I flunked the first time, actually, but a couple months later, yes, I did.
But you did take the test.
Yes, I did.
And I'm so glad we're learning this about you. And I got mine on my 16th, and most of my friends did.
Right.
My daughter waited 2.5 years,
hmm.
and she gets tired of sitting in a car. She has no interest in it. And I think we have a generation of people for whom the romance of the car is just different. And they don't want to drive as much. And I personally, we'll see where the stats come out, but I think that's going to be the biggest driver.
Non-driver,
excuse me.
And people are also willing, I suppose, to take public transit more than they used to be?
Yes. And we do find in the United States that really does correlate to the cost of gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
So now that it's popping back up toward the $4 range, there seems to be some magic zone where people start to ask themselves whether it's worth the money to drive someplace. In Germany, they're way ahead of us. And in fact, in a lot of European countries, they have gasoline taxes that create a fuel price that's 2 or 3 times our price. And they are already driving much more efficient cars. And they just choose to drive less. But if you ask them, they don't feel at all deprived.
Michael Potts is my guest. He's president and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute, which has just published the book Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Michael will be speaking tonight at 6 to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can find information about that appearance at dallasinstitute.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is President and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute, Michael Potts. The Institute has just published a book called Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Michael will be speaking this evening at 6 to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I do want to touch on air travel before we move on from transportation, because for the foreseeable future, planes will need jet fuel.
We don't have a quick way around that right now. You're right. And there are a lot of great innovations being tested by some airlines to use biofuel, and a lot by the U.S. government, just because they want to reduce their dependence on oil. But we run into the same thing with trucking. You can make trucks or airplanes three times as efficient, but because of the nature, the amount of thrust they require, in both cases, we can't get beyond having liquid fuel.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, obviously it would be to the financial advantage of companies that are running airplanes and running freight trucks to use as little fuel as possible.
Yeah. There are some big technological barriers to making these changes. But at RMI, just to talk about trucking for a second, we worked with the trucking industry and a lot of big clients like Walmart and the U.S. Army, et cetera, and came up with a very exciting strategy as to how to really drive toward three times as efficient trucks as there are today. And that spun out into an organization called the North America Council on Freight Efficiency. Now, you can check out their website. They're doing excellent work. From the air standpoint, actually Boeing has there have been some production delays, but they're shipping their first super efficient airplane that has a lot of composite components, and we think that will definitely be a big shift. As you mentioned, airlines, when oil prices are high, a huge, just scary amount of their costs are in fuel, and they're trying to do whatever they can to figure it out. But the science isn't as clear on how you can make a complete exit on that.
So you mentioned working with industry. You also work with the energy industry. There's a foreword to the book written by Marvin Odom, who is president of Shell Oil. What are those relationships like, and how tense or how cordial are those discussions that you have with, say, the petroleum industry?
You know, it's interesting. We do a lot of work with oil companies because they know energy, and they're trying to figure out how to become more efficient and effective. And we've worked with them on changing their refinery processes and a lot of other things. When we work with the executives of especially the oil industry, they're scientists. I mean, they get this, and they see climate change. And, climate change, there is some controversy about it, but not in the oil companies, mm-hmm. interestingly. Well, I shouldn't speak for all, but the ones that we work with. I will say that they see that we need to make an energy change. And just as one example, the French oil company Total just bought a majority of SunPower, which is the biggest U.S. Solar photovoltaic company. So in my opinion, the smart energy people look at themselves as energy business people, and they'll use their basis of oil and their capital base and their expertise and their ability to analyze and distribute, and they're shifting into renewables. At the same time, you know, there are other companies, like any industry, there's some companies that are way ahead of the curve and others that are just focused on this year.
I want to talk about buildings, because we always start these conversations with transportation, but it's easy to forget that 42% of the energy we use goes to structures.
Exactly right.
So talk a little bit about why we are so stuck in right now energy that comes from conventional fuel sources to power our homes.
You know, buildings is an interesting case because we all take them for granted, and we've built so many of them in the last 100 years. And it's because of the way that our financial structure is, energy takes a very small percentage of most budgets for a business, but also has a huge amount of leverage. We did a bunch of work on the Empire State Building, and I'm going to talk about that project in some detail tonight. But we found that when we went in there, like most buildings, every day of the year, summer or winter, the air conditioning was running and the heating was running because of imbalances in the building. And the wildest thought was that 30% of the office workers in the middle of summer had space heaters under their desks to keep them warm because the air conditioning was so cold. They had space heaters fighting the air conditioning, which was fighting the sun outside. And I mean, it's just an energy nightmare. So what we do is we help the owners of these buildings understand how to completely restructure the building, the lights, the windows, everything, and change the very nature of the building. We find with the Empire State Building, we were shooting for 40% energy savings, paid back in 3 years, and they're actually beating the projections. When you start with a new building, you can design it from the ground up. But and there's some very exciting buildings happening right now. But to us, the really thorny challenge is going after the buildings that were already there.
And that makes it so different from transportation, because we can assume that most vehicles that exist today will be off the road in a decade or so. On the other hand, you know, there are lots of houses out there, lots of office buildings that have been around for decades and will be for the foreseeable future.
Well, and you're touching on, to me, what is a fascinating challenge we have in the U.S. If you think about it, in the last century, in the 20th century, I think historians will call it the fossil fuel age, where we really created an entirely new world for ourselves by using fossil fuels, you know. And if last year the race was to burn the most fossil fuels, you know, to create the most buildings, build the most cars, the most roads, the most factories, I mean, we won that. We won that race without a doubt. And that's why even now we have 5% of the population in the U.S., but we burn about 23% of the energy to build a great economy for us. If the next race is to create the best lifestyle for your nation with the least amount of fossil fuels, we still are saddled with some of the structures that created the 20th century for us. And one of the facts is the buildings. I mean, sometimes you'll hear in the news how people will travel to Singapore or even to the third world and they see these big gleaming new airports and they come back to the U.S. and ours are old infrastructure. Our office buildings, our homes, are burning a lot of fossil fuels that are underpriced because our economic system underprices energy for us. And it's just it's basically degrading our ability to be a productive society. And one thing we do as an institute is we go after those existing buildings and we try to help the owners make changes to them. Here are a couple examples of why it's difficult. The way we lease buildings in the U.S. in most cities, if the landlord makes the building more energy efficient, the tenant saves the money, but the landlord doesn't. So how do you motivate a landlord who has plenty of other things to do to make that investment? Well, you can come up with a green lease where you share the savings, and that's a win-win. Well, at the Empire State Building, they did that, but they had to renegotiate 500 leases to get it done. So these are the types of barriers we have because our business systems and our business models were established in the 20th century.
What are the impediments to using technologies like solar panels to allow buildings to generate at least some of their own energy?
Well, actually, there are a number of impediments. The first is the cost of solar power, which is just plummeting in price, but it still isn't cost effective in all situations. The other issue is that this is one thing we preach over and over again. If you just bolt a solar panel on an inefficient building, it doesn't make sense. So what we say is efficiency first. Take the building as it is, improve it, make it as efficient as you possibly can, and then satisfy that refined, smaller, more specific need. Satisfy that with renewables, and then you've got something that is effectively off the grid or zero energy and is really a sustainable good investment.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send an email to think@kera.org. First on the phone, we have Sterling calling from Denton. Hi, Sterling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guest, I've been doing some research on my own about a company called United Nuclear, who claims to have a prototype that stores hydrogen and produces hydrogen and stores it in a specific isotope of metal halide or hydride that makes it less combustible, etc. I wanted to ask your guest about the current state of hydrogen technology, its ability to be converted into, you know, such as conversion kits for automobiles and home usage, and maybe some of the industry sort of entrenched positions that are in opposition to this technology becoming more prolific.
That's a great question, and I'm not familiar with the specific company that you mentioned. However, I will say that there's a lot of very interesting innovation going on. And it looks to us as if the challenge that you're mentioning a technological challenge, where we really do see an opportunity there for a new energy infrastructure that would be cost effective, but there are it seems to be the cost of specific chemicals that's keeping that in the marketplace, out of the marketplace, rather than the usability of the technology itself.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Jeff in Plano. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm wondering, is there much research going into heat management? For instance, the ability to capture the heat created by a structure, and instead of blowing it out through the compressor outside into the outdoor air, to be able to recapture it, like either, you know, drop the compressor unit into the hot water heater and get the heat back that way, or, you know, route the heat out of the compressor to like some sort of storage, like oil or something, but just some way of recapturing the heat we lose, and then we have to regenerate it again later on in the winter from natural gas or whatever.
Waste heat is a huge opportunity, and there are a lot of organizations working on it. Everything from devices that can just sit in a hot place and turn that heat into electricity to, as you mentioned, more whole systems approaches to recycle waste heat. In fact, I'd say the biggest revolution in electricity generation right now is coming from repurposing the waste heat. Right now, in a coal plant, for example, 60 to 70% of the potential energy is lost through waste heat. Now, there are all kinds of ways that people are trying to take that and repurpose it back into the system. That's an insightful question, because most energy systems lose over 90% of the energy potential, and most of that comes from waste heat. So I'd say if you look at the engineers and the way they're reworking the systems, that's one of the biggest areas of inquiry right now.
That actually brings us nicely to the topic of manufacturing and industry, because waste energy is a big deal, and there is a huge amount of money and energy spent on heating substances, right, and turning motors.
Yeah, we have a thing. If you, by the way, not to pitch the book too hard, but Reinventing Fire, if you can find it a number of places, including Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but it does talk a lot about some of the new changes in industry. And really, the breakthrough for world industry in the last 150 years is largely the application of heat and pressure to substances to create all new types of devices and chemicals, etc. There's a whole new green manufacturing movement just trying to figure out how you can make things without having to, number one, consume so much energy and also create so many harmful byproducts. And one example is a spider web. And, you know, a spider web itself has amazing tensile strength. It's created just chemically at room temperature. And there's a science called biomimicry now, mm-hmm. that is trying to take earth science processes and apply them to industry. So there, again, if you have a huge industrial complex that was built in the get or done century, you know, when it was just about building out as quickly as possible, what we're doing is kind of reworking all that to say, what if we build a factory as if energy matters? What if we built a factory and tried to say, we're not going to waste any heat, we're going to use it all? It causes all kinds of innovation and creativity.
How good are we at storing excess energy? If we can't use it right now, it just goes to waste.
That's one of the interesting things, and that's one of the reasons why gasoline is so effective, because it's a very inexpensive way to hold potential energy and move it around. In the electrical system, there is effectively no storage. I mean, there's starting to be some, but if you take all the batteries in the world, it creates all the batteries ever created in the world and being used, it adds up to less than 1 minute's worth of our energy use worldwide. So storage is a huge opportunity. There are billions of dollars going into how can we create electricity with wind at night and then use it when we need it. And by the way, in Reinventing Fire, we didn't assume any research breakthroughs, but every 2 or 3 months I talk to another VC who says, we cracked it. We have it. We're just about to commercialize it. So we'll see where that goes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Mike in Plano. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Chris. And Michael, I would like to ask a question about energy balance. You know, we always talk about the cost of something. A good example is solar cells. We say, it costs so much to make a solar panel, and we get this free energy after a certain period of time. But the amount of energy it goes into actually making it doesn't seem to have much correspondence to the cost. And we say, oh, we can buy a solar cell for so much, but then if we look at really the energy balance, I did a calculation some time ago, and it takes 7 to 8 years to actually recover the so-called free energy from a solar cell.
Well, hang on there, Mike, because we need to take a quick break. We will get a response from Michael Potts for you in just a minute. He is, of course, our guest this hour. He's president and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute, which has just published the book Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Michael is in town to speak this evening at 6 to the Dallas Institute for Humanities and Culture. If you want to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Michael Potts is with us this hour. He's president and CEO of Rocky Mountain Institute, which has just published the book Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. He's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute for Humanities and Culture. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, which before the break, Michael, is where we heard from Mike, who was interested in the time it takes for an investment in, say, solar panels to actually pay itself back.
Right. Well, actually, Mike's question, I read it that he had calculated the amount of energy it took to create the solar panels and was interested in, and it looked as if the panels themselves would require 7 years of capturing energy before you, in effect, balanced out the amount of energy that went into the solar panels.
To produce them and deliver them and install them.
Exactly. And it's a very interesting thought, and it's very sophisticated. A lot of people are doing research on it right now. Here's kind of a framing of it. There's a rough calculation that says that, when Spindletop was the big breakthrough oil find in Texas in 1902, I think, they say that the energy return on energy was about 100 to 1. For example, if you used a certain amount of energy to find oil, the amount of oil you unleashed was 100 times the amount of energy you used, even including the bad wells. Today, that's down to about 10 to 1. So you use about a tenth of the energy to get oil that you get out of oil. And Mike brings up an interesting point, which, by the way, there are very smart people calculating how much embedded energy is in a cheeseburger or in a Cadillac. And it's a very good question because it's a way that as a culture we can become more conscious of how much energy goes into our goods so that we can start making better decisions. Now, I haven't seen Mike's calcs, but he said that it takes 7 years for us to generate as much energy as goes into a solar panel. And that very well may be true. I can't tell you whether it is or not. But I will tell you, most of them have a useful life of 30 years. So you could justify it that way. Another real aspect is that there's a portability aspect where sometimes you'll consume energy embedding it in one product just so that it's available when you need it elsewhere. So another justification for putting 7 years worth of energy into a solar panel is that after that, you can put it on a house and it makes this energy available at the place of the house from then on. But Mike's got a very good question, and there are some really smart people looking at it from a cultural standpoint that say that those cultures who have the lowest amount of energy waste in their system are going to be much more wealthy in the long run.
How do we move electric generation plants from a 68% dependence on fossil fuels?
Basically, there are a couple things. We think the most important and most powerful thing is to move the generation of electricity closer to where it's being used. The system we have now was really designed in the early 1900s when our technology was completely different. And it was largely a political artifact where you create these huge plants out in the middle of nowhere that pump electricity through wires. And now that's expensive, it's addicted to fossil fuels, and it's also very risky from a reliability standpoint. So we see a future where there's a lot more energy generated in the community, where communities make joint decisions about how to generate energy and who to maintain it. There are more white-collar jobs everywhere maintaining this. And the sad fact right now is that Northern Europe is way ahead of the United States on this. Denmark is just every year they increase. They have much less sun than we do, paradoxically, but they use more and more renewables every year, and they're taking a community approach, and they've broken the country up into little power cells so that each one of these cells starts to make their own decision about how to generate energy in a way that fits for that climate and the needs, the local needs, etc., and they're all backed up by a grid that helps even everything off. That's where the U.S. needs to get. But I'll tell you, our current business models are the biggest challenge for that.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like there's a huge investment in infrastructure having things operate the way they have for a century.
Exactly. And we're looking at a $6 trillion infrastructure upgrade no matter what we do in the next 40 years, just because everything is wearing out. And we could use that $6 trillion to create a new energy era or to create more of the same. And that's one of the things RMI is really working on, to try to work with the leaders of the industry to help them chart a path forward that's better for the world and uses a lot less fuel.
Why is nuclear not part of the formula for you?
Well, we wrote this book before Fukushima happened, which brings a lot of security and safety issues that we didn't fit for us. But we did have nuclear as a reasonable candidate for the future. The challenge is, especially building new nuclear, it's so expensive that it just didn't compete with renewables as the cost of renewables is coming down.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phones to Sue in Dallas. Hello, Sue.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Your panelists had spoken earlier about how Europeans don't use their cars much, and I've actually lived in Copenhagen on two occasions in my life, going to school and traveled all around Europe on a train. And what I found with the trains in Europe is they take you to places that people want to go. Here in Dallas, there's no train to any mall here or to the airport, or, you know, you could take a train to Switzerland and go skiing, and you take trains that take thousands of people to a shopping area, but there's nothing. I'd like to see the trains that are developed take people to places that they actually go.
What do you think, Michael?
Sue, you're exactly right. There's a big challenge in creating mass transit in a city that was built around the car. And one of the beauties in Europe is they largely built their cities around trains because they didn't have cars when they were building the cities. Even in the U.S., if you look at the difference between New York or Boston versus Dallas or L.A., let's say, these are the post-car cities that are sprawled out all over the place. And if you try to come in after the fact and create mass transit, there aren't those centers, those hubs that you can move from and to. Interestingly, though, Sue, we are seeing a new urban infill movement that is building. And I live in Denver, for example, and we've got public transit that is pretty good. And whenever they announce a new station, there's a huge development, an infill development movement around it with movie theaters, apartment buildings. And we find that people in urban infill, they need five things. They need where they live, where they work, what they call a third place, your restaurant or bar, or library, wherever you like to hang out, some nature and rapid transit. If those five things are within a half mile of their house, car ownership just drops off. People become happier, thinner, and that's kind of the U.S. moving back toward more of a centralized, vibrant urban approach. By the way, there's a similar movement happening in suburbs now that is very exciting, of kind of a re-centralization where hubs are starting to grow where there weren't hubs. But so what you mentioned is, I think, the source of a lot of longing for people that live in cities like Dallas, where they just want a place where they don't have to get in their car all the time.
Do you imagine that in 2050, the sort of car culture that we have created in this country will not be a factor?
I think it will look much different, and I think we will not be as mobile, but not in a kind of deprivation way, more that we're going to choose. People will be more thoughtful about location. Even now, there's a very strong trend where younger professional people trade off what they call context for square footage and land, where the context is, what school is my child going to go to? How cool are the restaurants? How close am I to things? Now real estate sales websites have walkability indexes, mm-hmm. which you just didn't see 5 years ago. There's kind of a reverse sprawl movement going on. And it's not anti-suburb. I mean, it's more saying, how can we be thoughtful about the infrastructure we've worked in and make it better for humans?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Steve in Fort Worth. Hello, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Question I have, and it pretty much keeps looping back, I think, to the same thing for any kind of renewable energy, is fossil fuels are going to go away, and it's the storage of electricity. So I was wondering if they did any research on the possibility of fuel cell cars. I know there were some recent developments for the platinum that was needed. They have come up with a new substance to dramatically lower the cost of fuel cell technology. Just seeing what his insight is on that.
Well, I see a horse race happening, that there's a lot going on in just flat-out battery technology. There's a lot going on in efficiency. There's a car coming out in India, which is a compressed air car, that they're saying that they've got compressed air technology down, and once they nail it in India, it's going to take off all over the world. And we've been big fans of fuel cells for a long time, and fuel cells are gaining momentum now, actually, surprisingly, in buildings, where they're finding applications where building owners can save money if they use fuel cells to reduce their amount of energy use during peak periods. So I'm not I read about the breakthrough that you mentioned to replace platinum with fuel cells. We'll see. We think that we're not sure which way it's going to go, but we do see enough technologies emerging. It's almost like there are two sides to this game right now. One is the research and generation of technology, and the other side is the application of technology. And on the research side, we're seeing a lot of really exciting things happening, and there's a huge amount of capital going into research in those spaces. Also, if you go to MIT especially, and Stanford, you see what kind of minds are focusing on the energy space, and they're just getting started. So that's on the research and development side. And then on the application side, there are new players jumping in. We know quite well that some of the very, very big retailers want to break right through the car dealership world, for example, and start selling breakthrough vehicles, you know, the way that they sell bicycles now. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that happen in 10 years. And from the application side or from the distribution side, they really don't care whether they're fuel cells or batteries. It's kind of going to be just a technological horse race, I think.
What are the best things we can do to motivate innovation? I mean, obviously, you know, the prize of selling something that really works is wonderful. But how do we get more people involved in this kind of research?
I'd say that's a fascinating question. And one of the challenges I run into is there are so many brilliant, especially young people, who say, I want to get into this. I really want to play in the energy game. And in this field, as in many others, jobs are just not plentiful right now. There are some movements to create jobs in the green space, but most of them are not on the innovation side. Most of them are on the implementation side. Right, the government has given some funding, but that seems to be declining. And I'd say, as a nation, our biggest challenge right now is diverting enough funding into this space, because China and India are doing it. And in terms of our long-term global competitiveness, that's going to be a challenge. I'll say, in the U.S., what impresses me the most are the businesses that are already working in the energy space or in the distribution space that are just starting to put some resources into it. And we see it across the board. We see oil companies doing very innovative things. We see communications companies. As I mentioned, Google is a search company, and they're creating driverless cars. I'd say when I see young people, I advise them in general, find an innovative company and get on a team someplace.
Michael Potts is president and CEO of the Rocky Mountain Institute, which has just published a book called Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Michael will be speaking tonight at 6 to the Dallas Institute for Humanities and Culture. Michael, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast, all at kera.org/think. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for the show, send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.